Many Jews today condemn Israel's Holocaust against the people of Gaza and their civilization, asserting, "Not in our names." But the current military frenzy is part of a long violent process. From the Wings Archives, 1990, six Jewish women from Israel and the U.S. tell Susan Rivo what opened their eyes and made them say, "Not in our names."
It just reached a point where I couldn't stand my own silence anymore, and I felt like if I was feeling that, probably a lot of other Jewish people were feeling that too.
That's Miranda Bergman of the Break the Silence Mural Project, a group of four Jewish women artists who traveled to the Israeli-occupied West Bank to paint murals with Palestinian artists.
We formed the Break the Silence Mural Project because we wanted to do something to make a statement as American Jews in solidarity with the Palestinian struggle for independence and as a voice for peace and reconciliation between Jewish people and Palestinian people. This was the first time that I think any of us did anything in our work as Jewish people, and it was a pretty profound experience and very important for us. Personally, I was raised to believe that one of the things to feel really good about being a Jew was that Jews were people that had a tradition of standing for freedom and against oppression, and that we were a people who had known both oppression and resistance. Passover was always my favorite holiday as a child because that was talking about, you know, slavery and liberation, and my parents, who were progressive people very much so, used that time as a time to instill pride in us as Jews for that reason, because of that tradition, the tradition of standing for justice. And we really felt that by doing this project and encouraging other Jews to sort of break out of their fear and their paralysis, that it's reclaiming the best of our traditions, and that in fact what's happening now in our name, I mean, Shamir and those people, they come and they speak and they say, "We are doing this for all Jews, all American Jews and Jews all over the world," and that's a lie. In fact, what they're doing, I really feel, is a betrayal of our tradition, is a betrayal of the best of our tradition. So really, we feel like we're claiming it, and far from being self-hating, we're in love with our traditions and feel wholer now than we ever have as Jewish people.
Bergman says that negative stereotyping of Palestinians has prevented Jews and other Americans from recognizing their distinct and vital culture. She says the media has conducted a sophisticated campaign to portray the Palestinian as terrorist.
It's like Palestinian terrorist, all one word. That is, thank goodness, starting to break down now. But until a year or two ago, the general attitude of U.S. citizens in general, and especially Jews, was that the Palestinians were crazy terrorists out to kill them. And that is really a distortion and a slander and a demonization of that people and their long struggle and their culture, which is very rich. We are cousins. I mean, we are Semitic peoples, and we are cousins. And you see similarities in music, in love of learning, in humor, in a certain kind of family thing. A lot of similarities, and then differences also. There's a lot of basis for alliance among Jewish people and Palestinian people. I'm really convinced of that.
In addition to painting murals, they taught art classes to children whose schools had been closed by the Israeli military. She describes the reaction the four Jewish women received upon arriving in the West Bank.
We encountered some surprise, some shock, a few people whose faces fell on the floor, and they picked them up real fast when they found out we were Jewish. We were always totally out as Jews. It was part of the reason to make the trip. But we found a lot of, even if there was initial shock, that the communication ran much deeper after that. People really did differentiate and welcomed us, embraced us, I mean, as family, really truly as family, and had a lot of stories about how their mother had this best friend who was Jewish, and this recipe was from some Jewish woman they knew. And, you know, the younger kids, a lot of them had never known Jews except for in the context of a soldier shooting them or beating them. And we felt gladder that we were there because it helped to break that down.
Bergman also notes the important role women are playing in Palestinian society.
One of the most joyful things about the trip was our whole relationship with Palestinian women and the privilege we felt of being able to be so included in the life of the Palestinian women we were around. Just living the daily life, and the daily lives of women in Palestine has really taken these amazing changes and leaps since the Intifada. It's like an explosion of new opportunities and liberation in a lot of ways, partially because so many thousands of men have been jailed, partially because it's this whole awakening and uprising that really pulls out of everyone their participation, or the great majority of people, including the women.
Marcia Friedman lived in Israel from 1967 to 1981. She helped found the first battered women's shelter, the first rape crisis center, and the first legal aid society for women. She was also a member of the Knesset and an early advocate of a two-state solution. Friedman explains how the women on both sides of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict have made the first moves towards peace.
We very naturally established bridges to the women on the other side, that is to the quote-unquote enemy. The sense of identification with the losses that Palestinian women were suffering, the sense of identification with their struggle, and I think from the Palestinian women's side to the Israeli women, the sense of what they were losing because of the occupation, of increasing violence within Israel, increasing rise of the radical right, which is always bad for women. I think that these things were playing themselves out, and I think those are the reasons. The collaborative, cooperative relationships developed first among Palestinian and Israeli women, and then later in the larger peace movement. Certainly within the peace movement, women have taken the lead both among Palestinians and among the Israelis. And this has happened since the Intifada began, but I think it was imminent all along. The women have much less to lose. All women, always in these sorts of roles, have much less to lose. They do not have fancy university positions for the most part, or access to media. They don't have privilege within the society. And so they're not worried about losing their privilege if they're too radical or if they step over the line.
Friedman believes American Jews have an important role to play. There are a number of organizations in the United States that influence U.S. policy toward Israel. Though these organizations claim to represent the entire Jewish community in the U.S., the men who head them have never been elected by the Jewish public. With half of all American Jews unaffiliated with any Jewish organization or synagogue, it seems clear that organizations such as AIPAC, the American Israel Political Action Committee, a lobbying group that supports virtually all the policies of the Israeli government, represent only a small, though powerful, segment of the Jewish community.
My feeling right now is that the ball is in the court of the American Jewish community, and that the key to what's going to happen over the next several years in Israel, because I do believe this government will last, depends upon not only American foreign policy, but upon the reactions and responses of the American Jewish community. I've been involved with organizing Women in Black here in San Francisco, but I have now begun to give a lot of thought, and I'm going to be giving a lot of energy to the Jewish Peace Lobby, which is trying to organize as a countervailing power to AIPAC. I think there are a lot of things we can do. I think one of the main problems that progressive American Jews have is that we have always resisted being part of the organized Jewish community, the quote-unquote establishment of the Jewish community. And so therefore we've really left a vacuum, and you know, there's a voice out there that is speaking for all Jews because nobody else has a voice. So I think that one of the most important things right now is to begin to organize that other voice, the progressive voice within the community, and I think it's a very large one, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if it were in a majority.
Friedman believes there has been an oversimplification of the issue of Soviet immigration to Israel. Despite the recent announcement by the Israeli government that Soviet immigrants would not be settled in the West Bank, Friedman says that the housing crisis already existing in Israel will force native Israelis into the occupied territories, potentially displacing still more Palestinians.
If the amount of housing that is going to be built within the next 2 years is only equal to the number of Jews emigrating from the Soviet Union, and that housing will be built within the Green Line for the Soviet Jewry, it still means that there's going to be an awful shortage of housing for native-born Israelis who are going to find that they can only go to live on the West Bank because that's the only place they can find a place to live.
Recently, the United States agreed to a request from Israel that it drastically reduce quotas for Soviet Jewish immigration into the U.S.
I think that it is absolutely deplorable that the United States government has established quotas, but the American Jewish community has said not a single word against it. The parallels to the 1930s are just so incredible, and here we are just doing nothing at all. If there was open immigration, open gates to Soviet Jewry into the United States, Soviet Jewry would not be a problem in terms of Middle East politics whatsoever, because clearly most of them would choose to come here.
Penny Rosenwasser is a longtime community activist and journalist. Like many Jewish feminists inspired by the example of women of color who had confronted racism in the women's movement and reclaimed their cultural identities, Rosenwasser began to identify strongly with her Jewishness.
We celebrated the holidays and that kind of thing, but I was not wild about being a Jew. I was not wild about being different. And I think as I got older, I got active on the left, but never saw issues around being Jewish as very important. In fact, they seemed very unimportant. So I would call myself on some level at that point a self-hating Jew. And then in the mid-70s, late-70s, this book, Nice Jewish Girls, came out, and I really identified. I loved that. I learned a lot from it, and I got very into being Jewish and very proud of it, and in fact became an ardent Zionist, because I really understood for the first time about anti-Semitism around the world and what had happened, not just the Holocaust, but even before that. And really got into the idea of having a Jewish homeland, and that felt very important to me. After the invasion of Lebanon in 1982, my Zionist friends justified that for me. You know, Israelis may have been killing little Palestinian kids, but that's because they were throwing bombs, so what's the choice? And so I lived with that, and it was really maybe in 1984, 85, I was at the Vancouver Folk Festival, and a friend of mine was managing the dance brigade at that time. And she really encouraged me to come see a piece they were doing on Sabra and Shatila. And I was very uneasy about it, but I did, and I sat down with her, and I watched that piece, and I started sobbing. And I realized that I didn't know at that point how to bring together the fact that I felt very proud to be a Jew and what Judaism stood for in the world, and the fact that something was going on by the Israeli government that was breaking my heart, and that was very against the things I was fighting for in Central America, in South Africa, as a lesbian, etc.
Rosenwasser recently returned from a trip to Israel and the occupied territories, where she interviewed both Palestinian and Israeli women.
To me, there's no justification for the treatment I saw of Palestinians. I can't have my freedom built on the back of somebody else. That's not freedom. You know, that's precarious. That's not the kind of life I want to live. I think there's another choice. And it may mean we have to compromise. Hey, you know, that's life. But there's a way that I can be happy, and that I think Jews can find some level of peace and serenity and it not be at the expense of another people.
Rosenwasser explains that she had to unlearn some of her own stereotypes about Jewish people, even the positive ones.
I've certainly had this image, oh, we're for social justice, and if nothing else, the experience of the government of Israel teaches me we're no chosen people. We're no better than anyone. We're as wonderful as everyone, and we have all the problems and all the weaknesses and all the fallacies, and that's good for me to know.
On Wings, this is Susan Rivo's 1990 documentary titled Not in Our Names.
Naomi Seidman is a graduate student studying Jewish literature in Yiddish, Hebrew, English, and German. After living in Israel for several years, she realized her concerns were not only for Jews, but for Palestinians as well.
What happens to me politically is an obsession with Israel, with dealing with the problems, and this is sort of new for me to think about the Palestinians too, and it's just a commitment to think about both peoples and all peoples.
Seidman explains that her political changes did not come easily.
I just want to make clear what the emotional freight was that Israel always had for me. I mean, it was never separate from the murder of my father's 8 brothers and sisters. It was never separate from his experiences in the Warsaw Ghetto. For a minute, it was his story. It was a story of a survivor. And he always invested it with not only his own history, but the history of 6 million murdered Jews. I still feel the strength of his argument, but I guess I'm beginning to listen to other people's stories too. I'm recognizing that my father's story isn't the only story in the world, and I'm beginning to hear Palestinian stories and stories of non-Zionist Jews, and recognizing that history is something which has a million stories.
Seidman draws upon the philosophies of Hannah Arendt and Judah Magnus, early Zionists who foresaw the imminent destruction of European Jewry. They advocated a binational homeland for Arabs and Jews, but opposed the establishment of a Jewish state.
For me, it's kind of encouraging to find out that Judaism isn't a monolithic idea, but that as progressives in this particular cause, we can look at a specific history which was never acted on, maybe, but which is still there. The kinds of things that Judah Magnus and Hannah Arendt were formulating in the late 30s and early 40s about forming a binational state. There was always another strain of Judaism, and we don't need to create ourselves from scratch, but to reactivate strands of Jewish thought and Jewish history which have been suppressed. And it's encouraging to feel that our place is as Jewish as anyone else's, even though it hasn't been part of the dominant mainstream.
Bracha Seri is an Israeli Jew who was born in Yemen. Her political activity began at the other end of the spectrum, in the religious settler movement. Believing that settlement was the way to peace, Seri tried to increase the representation of Sephardic Jews among the settlers, who were mainly Western Jews. Not until she began teaching Hebrew to Arabs did she learn that the settler ideology encouraged oppressing and killing Palestinians.
And so I understood that in order to make peace, we have, first of all, maybe to understand, listening to the so-called enemy, because we can't just solve the things among ourselves and just deny the existence of the other. And so I started talking to Arabs more and more, and I got information that I never knew it through newspapers and radio.
She feels that the Holocaust is unfairly used to justify policies toward Palestinians.
They're fighting for survival like we are in biblical time or in the Holocaust. And then hate Arabs because of the Holocaust. It's not fair. Israel sends arms to Germany and brings the Holocaust all the time to encourage the war against the Arabs. And it's not true historically, because Jews in the Middle East, in Arab countries, have lived there, and they didn't suffer as much as in Christian or European countries, not to mention the Holocaust.
The Spirit of God is so proud. Let the healing between Sarah and Hagar be the peace between Isaac and Ishmael.
I grew up as an American Jew who lived in a home where we were all very strong supporters of the policies of Israel and never would question Israel. It wasn't until 1984, when I became a delegate for Jesse Jackson at the National Democratic Convention, that I met the first Palestinians that I ever knew and who have, until this day, remained very close friends of mine. Even after meeting them, I remained silent on the issue of Israel and the Palestinians. President of the Board of Education in Berkeley, and when I decided not to run for re-election, it was right around the beginning of the Intifada. And I would watch CNN, and I would see these young soldiers, these Jewish boys, beating people, shooting people, and I couldn't believe what I saw. I mean, it just really shocked me. I grew up believing that Jewish people don't do this, that Jewish people don't beat their wives, they don't drink, that we have this higher moral ground. And I was shocked.
That's Barbara Lubin, executive director of the Middle East Children's Alliance. Active on progressive issues for many years, especially in causes around children, Lubin was devastated by what she saw on the television news. In 1988, she organized a delegation of elected officials on a fact-finding mission to the occupied territories.
We were just totally blown away by what we saw. I mean, we witnessed beatings, shootings. We were caught in the middle of a gun battle. We were stopped by Israeli soldiers and body searched and abused, and we were tear gassed. We were in a home just talking to some Palestinians, and Israeli helicopters flew overhead and shot tear gas into the home. And when we would try and get out of the house, they would shoot more tear gas at us. So we witnessed firsthand what was going on there for Palestinians.
As a longtime disability activist and a mother of four, including a Down syndrome child, Lubin has been active on issues of education and children's rights.
So I felt like I wanted to do something for the kids, that I was just couldn't believe what was happening and what the lives were like for the children of Palestine. So we started the Middle East Children's Alliance in May of 88, and we have literally been working around the clock since that time. And in the last 2 years, we've taken 45 people over on delegations, and we've sent over about $100,000, or taken over about $100,000 for projects that we're supporting. Medical clinics, pediatric clinics in Kalandia Refugee Camp and Jabalia Refugee Camp, preschools.
Lubin believes American Jews have a special responsibility to speak out.
Those of us who are Jewish and have come out on this issue and are standing up and speaking out have got to find ways to approach the other people in the Jewish community in this country and move them over and make them understand what's happening. And if they don't care about what's happening to Palestinians, then they must care about what's happening to Israelis. Since the beginning of the Intifada, approximately 50 young Israeli soldiers have committed suicide. The incidence of wife beating has risen very high. The effects on Israeli society are profound. And if you love Israel, if they love Israel, then they will work to see that there's a resolve to this whole issue.
Lubin recently returned from a delegation that met with a number of Israeli and Arab officials, including Shimon Peres, head of the Labor Party. She describes her impression of the meeting.
I thought that he was racist. Somebody asked him about the school closures, and he sort of poo-pooed it, and it wasn't important, and, you know, after all, they're where they're organizing, and somebody said, well, how much organizing could be done in a kindergarten? And he just sort of laughed it off. And then he talked about in Israel itself as a democracy, and Arabs and Jews are living together, and things are terrific. I just finally couldn't stand it any longer, and I just said, Mr. Peres, I said, I can't believe that you're talking about education so offhandedly. I said, for us as Jews, education means everything. I said, and you talk about it as if it's of no importance. I said, how come it's so important to us? I said, you know, I'm listening to you and you're breaking my heart. This is frightening. I said, have you ever been to the town of Lod? I said, there's a situation where Arabs and Jews are living together, except Jews live with electricity and indoor plumbing. And in Lod, in the Arab section of Lod, the Arabs, the Palestinians, are living with shit running down the street, with no electricity. I said, I met a little girl whose entire right side of her face had been eaten away by rat bites. We saw enormous rats running through this section of Lod. I said, what do you say to this? You know, he had said that there are equal services in all of these areas. I said, how can you lie like this? And he said, oh, they're Bedouin, and went on to the next question.
Lubin feels that some of the recent political stands taken by mainstream Jewish organizations, along with the policies of the Israeli government, are isolating Jews from the world community.
Recently, the Jewish community in the United States just keeps shooting itself in the foot. Jesse Jackson in New York, this whole Mandela thing has just been astounding. It just absolutely astounds me that we, or not we, some Jewish groups could attack Nelson Mandela. Why? Because he recognizes that the struggle of Palestinians is almost identical to the struggle of black South Africans, because he embraced Yasser Arafat? Well, it's just very sad.
Lubin believes that Israel's security depends on its recognition of Palestinian human and national rights.
Finding a place for Jews to live and to be secure and safe is a good idea. Can you be safe and secure at the expense of another people? I don't think so. I don't think there's ever going to be any real security for Jews in Israel until there's been a negotiated settlement with Palestinians. On the other hand, there are security issues for Israel. I mean, I think it has to be acknowledged that Iraq is not something to, you know, just pretend isn't there. There have been a lot of moves from Iraq and statements being made that are very frightening. And there are people out there that believe that Israel shouldn't exist. But I think that the reality is also that Israel has the fourth mightiest army in the world. They have over 200 nuclear bombs. I think they're in a pretty secure position. I think it's less a question of security for Israel than a loss of moral standing. And I think that Israel needs to save its soul, not its soil. Israel needs to look at itself. I mean, certainly their role in all over the map was just outrageous. In South Africa, in Central America, in Ethiopia. I mean, Israel can no longer talk about the moral high ground when they're sending cluster bombs and over 200 military advisors to Ethiopia killing children. Cluster bombs are outlawed in every international forum. And here we're killing children with cluster bombs. And to me, it's not clear whether it's the United States policy or it's Israel. But I believe that Israel is really a pawn of the United States, and that it's the expansionist policies of the United States that Israel's just carrying out.
Lubin says that people must understand that they can criticize these policies out of concern for Israel.
The most important thing people can understand is that you can care about Israel and what happens to the Jews there and criticize it. You know, when I was in jail and fighting against the Vietnam War, and I spent a lot of time, I was a draft counselor, and I was in and out of jail all the time in the 60s demonstrating. I felt I was very American by doing that. It was because of caring about America that I did that. And I remember people would say we were anti-American and the attacks that we came under. But, you know, we all stood up against that, and we made it very clear that we loved America, and that is why we were doing what we were doing.
An alternative voice exists and is growing within the Jewish community. Many Jewish women are feeling a particular responsibility to speak out against the policies carried out in our name. Special thanks to Jenny Schwartz and Chewy Varela. This program was co-produced and engineered by Barry Korngold. I'm Susan Revo. Thank you for listening.
Not in Our Names was produced by Susan Revo in 1990. It first aired in Wings in 1991. The Middle East Children's Alliance is still active in 2024. Wings thanks your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose events can be found at maternalgifteconomymovement.org. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.